Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate, Dr. Wilson, that very generous introduction, and I appreciate that very warm response. I was thinking as I came up here of an occasion a few years ago, several years ago, when I was publisher of Newsday on Long Island, and we lived right next to Adelphi University on the campus there, just lived half a block from it. And late one afternoon, the president of the university called me, and I was at my office, which was about 2 miles away, and he said, "Oh, we've had a real calamity here." He said, "We have a very important meeting of many of our alumni tonight. It's a big fundraising affair, and our speaker's plane has been diverted from LaGuardia, which is 30 minutes away. Would you come at the last minute and speak?" I said, "Well, yes. Will I be among friends?" And he said, "Yes, you'll be among friends." So I went, last minute, spoke. Audience was indifferent, shuffled their feet, drank their wine, pulled out notes and read it. And it wasn't a very auspicious evening. He took me home after it, and I said, "You know, I thought you said I was going to be among friends." He said, "You were. They just weren't your friends." Well, I can't tell you how good it is to be among my friends today. I needed it all the more because I came in late last night. I was hungry, went to the hotel, checked in, and decided to go to Charlie Gillis' famous Italian restaurant just about 4 blocks from here. And he welcomed me and offered me a drink. And I sat there, and he said, look behind you. And I turned around and looked, and there was a photograph right over my right shoulder, obviously, of Bill O'Reilly. And I couldn't tell whether he was sneering or leering, but it made me all the more grateful that I was coming here today. I can't imagine better company on this beautiful Sunday morning in St. Louis. Your church for me today. And there's no congregation in the country where I would be more likely to find more kindred souls than are gathered here. There are so many, thank you, there are so many different vocations and callings in this room. So many different interests and aspirations, from people who want to reform media and from those who want to produce for it, that only a presiding bishop like Bob McChesney's, with his great ecumenical heart, could bring us together for a weekend like this. I think we ought to skip the College of Cardinals and name Bob our Pope. He knew before anyone that there was a political constituency for a free press in America. And he and John and Josh and all of you who work for free press are proving that he was prophetic. I'm very pleased that the Schumann Center for Media and Democracy, which I serve, has been a generous supporter of this movement and will continue to be. What joins us all under Bob's embracing welcome is our commitment to public media. Pat Offord Heide got it right, I think, in the recent issue of In These Times when she said, "This is a moment when public media outlets can make a powerful case for themselves. Public radio, public TV, cable access, public DVS channels, media art centers, your media projects, nonprofit internet news services, low-power radio and webcasting," Pat wrote, "are all part of a nearly invisible feature of today's media map, the public media sector. They exist not to make a profit, not to push an ideology, not to serve customers, but to create a public, a group of people who can talk productively with those who disagree with them and defend the interests of the people who have to live with the consequences of corporate and governmental power." She gives examples of the possibilities. "Look at what happened," she said, "when thousands of people who watched Stanley Nelson's The Murder of Emmett Till on their public television channels joined a postcard campaign that reopened the murder case after more than half a century. Look, Look at NPR's courageous coverage of the Iraq War, an expensive endeavor that wins no points from this administration. Look at Chicago Access Network's community forum, where nonprofits throughout the region can showcase their issues and find volunteers. The public media, Pat argues, for all our flaws, and public broadcasting has more than its share of flaws and failures, is a crucial resource in this noisy and polluted information environment. You can also take wings reading Jason Miller's May 4th article on ZNet about the mainstream media. While it is true, he says, that much of the mainstream media is corrupted by the influence of corporate and government interests, there are still men and women in that mainstream who practice a high degree of journalistic integrity and who do challenge us with their stories and opinions. But the real hope, Miller writes, lies within the Internet with its 2 billion or more websites providing a wealth of information drawn from almost unlimited resources that span the globe. If knowledge is power, one's capacity to increase that power increases exponentially through navigation of the Internet for news and information. Surely, this is one issue that can unite us as we leave here today. The fight to preserve the web from corporate gatekeepers joins both media, reformers, producers, and educators, and it's a fight that has only just begun. But I want to tell you about another fight we're in. The story I've come to share with you goes to the core of our belief that the quality of democracy and the quality of journalism are deeply entwined. I can tell this story because I've been living it. As Dr. Wilson said, it's been in the news this week, including more attacks on a single journalist, yours truly, by the right-wing media and their friends at the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. As you know, CPB was established almost 40 years ago to set broad policy for public broadcasting and to be a firewall between political influence and program content. What some on its board are now doing today, led by its chairman, Kenneth Tomlinson, is too important, too disturbing, and yes, even dangerous for a gathering like this not to address it. We're seeing unfold a contemporary example of the age-old ambition of power and ideology to punish the journalists who tell the stories that make princes and priests uncomfortable. First, let me assure you that I take in stride attacks by the radical right-wingers who have not given up demonizing me, although I retired over 6 months ago. They've been after me for years now, and I suspect they will be stomping on my grave to make sure I don't come back from the dead. I should point out to them that one of our boys pulled it off some 2,000 years ago. After the Pharisees, the Sadducees, and Caesar's surrogates thought they'd shut him up for good. I won't be expecting that kind of miracle, but I should put my detractors on notice. They might just compel me out of the rocking chair and back into the anchor chair. Who are they? I mean the people obsessed with control, using the government to threaten and intimidate. I mean the people who are hollowing out middle-class security even as they enlist the sons and daughters of the working class to make sure Ahmad Shalabi winds up controlling Iraq's oil. I mean the people who turn faith-based initiatives into Karl Rove's slush fund, who encourage the pious to look heavenward and pray so as not to see the long arm of privilege and power picking their pockets. I mean I mean the people who squelch free speech in an effort to obliterate dissent and consolidate their orthodoxy into the official view of reality from which any deviation becomes unpatriotic heresy. That's who I mean. And if that's editorializing, so be it. A free press is one where it's okay to state the conclusion you're led to by the evidence. One reason I'm in hot water is because my colleagues and I now didn't play by the conventional rules of Beltway journalism. Those rules divide the world into Democrats and Republicans, liberals and conservatives, and allow journalists to pretend they have done their job if instead of reporting the truth behind the news, they merely give each side an opportunity to spin the news. Jonathan Merman writes about this in a recent essay in World Policy Journal. You'll also want to read his book, Debating War and Peace, Media Coverage of U.S. Intervention in the Post-Vietnam Era. Merman quotes David Ignatius of the Washington Post on why the deep interests of the American public are so poorly served by Beltway journalism. The rules of the game, says Ignatius, make it hard for us to tee up on an issue without a news peg. He offers a case in point, the debacle of America's occupation of Iraq. If Senator so-and-so hasn't criticized post-war planning for Iraq, says Ignatius, it's hard for a reporter to write a story about that. Merman also quotes public television's Jim Lehrer, whom I greatly respect, acknowledging that unless an official says something is so, it isn't news. Why were journalists not discussing the occupation of Iraq? Because, says Jim Lehrer, the word occupation was never mentioned in the run-up to the war. Washington talked about the war as a war of liberation, not a war of occupation. So as a consequence, those of us in journalism, says Lehrer, never even looked at the issue of occupation. In other words, says Jonathan Merman, if the government isn't talking about it, we don't report it. He concludes, Lehrer's somewhat jarring declaration, one of many recent admissions by journalists that their reporting failed to prepare the public for the calamitous occupation that has followed the liberation of Iraq, reveals just how far the actual practice of American journalism has deviated from the First Amendment idea of a press that is independent of government. Take the example, also cited by Merman, of Charles Hadley. Hadley is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for the Associated Press, whose 2003 story of the torture of Iraqis in American prisons, before a U.S. Army report and photographs documenting the abuse surfaced, was ignored by major American newspapers. Hadley attributes this lack of interest to the fact, quote, it was not an officially sanctioned story that begins with a handout from an official source. Furthermore, Iraqis recounting their own personal experience of Abu Ghraib simply did not have the credibility with Beltway journalists of American officials denying that such things happened. Judith Miller of the New York Times, among others, relied on that credibility of official but unnamed sources when she served essentially as the government's stenographer for claims that Iraq possessed weapons of mass destruction. So the rules of the game permit Washington officials to set the agenda for journalism, leaving the press all too simply to recount what the officials say instead of subjecting their words and deeds to critical scrutiny. Instead of acting as filters for readers and viewers, sifting the truth from the propaganda, reporters and anchors attentively transcribe both sides of the spin, invariably failing to provide context, background, or any sense of which claims hold up and which are misleading. I decided long ago that this wasn't healthy for democracy. I came to see that news is what people want to keep hidden and everything else is publicity. In my documentaries, whether on the Watergate scandal 30 years ago, or the Iran-Contra conspiracy 20 years ago, or Bill Clinton's fundraising scandals 10 years ago, or 5 years ago, the chemical industry's long and despicable cover-up of its cynical and unspeakable withholding of critical data about its toxic products, I realized that investigative journalism could not be a collaboration between the journalist and the subject. Objectivity was not satisfied by two opposing people offering competing opinions, leaving the viewer to split the difference. I came to believe that objective journalism means describing the object being reported on, including the little fibs and fantasies as well as the big lie of people in power. In no way does this permit journalists to make accusations and allegations. It means instead making sure that your reporting and your conclusions can be nailed to the post with confirming evidence. This is always hard to do, but it's never been harder. Without a trace of irony, the powers that be have appropriated the newspeak vernacular of George Orwell's 1984. They give us a program vowing no child will be left behind while cutting funds for educating disadvantaged children. They give us legislation cheerily calling for clear skies and healthy forests that give us neither while turning over our public lands to the energy industry. In Orwell's 1984, the character Syme, one of the writers of that totalitarian society's dictionary, explains to the protagonist, Winston, Don't you see that the whole aim of newspeak is to narrow the range of thought? Has it ever occurred to you, Winston, that by the year 2050, at the very latest, not a single human being will be alive who could understand such a conversation as we're having right now? The whole climate of thought, he said, will be different. In fact, there will be no thought as we understand it now. Orthodoxy means not thinking, not needing to think. Orthodoxy is unconsciousness. Hear me. An unconscious people, an indoctrinated people, a people fed only partisan information and opinion that confirm their own bias, a people made morbidly obese in mind and spirit by the junk food of propaganda, is less inclined to put up a fight, ask questions, and be skeptical. And just as a democracy can die of too many lies, that kind of orthodoxy can kill us too. I learned about this the hard way. I grew up in the South, where the truth about slavery, race, and segregation had been driven from the pulpits, driven from the classrooms, and driven from the newsrooms. It took a bloody civil war to bring the truth home, and then it took another 100 years for the truth to make us free. Then I served in the Johnson administration, imbued with Cold War orthodoxy, and confident that might makes right, we circled the wagons, listened only to each other, and pursued policies the evidence couldn't carry. The results were devastating for Vietnamese and Americans. I brought all of this to the task when PBS asked me after 9/11 to start a new weekly broadcast. They wanted us to make it different from anything else on the air, commercial or public broadcasting. They asked us to tell stories no one else was reporting, and to offer a venue to people who might not otherwise be heard. That wasn't a hard sell. I had been deeply impressed by studies published in two leading peer-reviewed scholarly journals by a team of researchers led by Vassar College's William Hoynes, who was here at this conference until this morning when he had to leave early. Their extensive research on the content of public television over a decade found that political discussions on our public affairs programs generally included a limited set of voices that offer a narrow range of perspectives on current issues and events. Instead of far-ranging discussions and debates, the kind that might engage viewers as citizens and not simply as audiences, this research found that public affairs programs on PBS stations were populated by the standard set of elite news sources, whether government officials and Washington journalists talking about political strategy, or corporate sources talking about stock prices or the economy from the investor's viewpoint. Public television, unfortunately, all too often was offering the same kind of discussions and a similar brand of insider discourse that is featured regularly on commercial television. They just weren't so noisy. Who didn't appear was also revealing. In contrast to the conservative mantra that public television routinely featured the voices of anti-establishment critics, the studies found that alternative perspectives were rare on public television and were effectively drowned out by the stream of government and corporate views that represented the vast majority of sources on our broadcasts. The so-called experts who got most of the face time came primarily from mainstream news organizations and Washington think tanks rather than diverse interests. Economic news, for example, was almost entirely refracted through the views of business people, investors, and business journalists, voices outside the corporate Wall Street universe, non-professional workers, labor representatives, consumer advocates, and the general public were rarely heard. In sum, these two studies concluded, the economic coverage was so narrow that the views and the activities of most citizens became irrelevant. All of this went against the Broadcasting Act of 1967 that created the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I know, I was there. As a young policy assistant to President Johnson, I attended in 1964 my first meeting to discuss the future of public broadcasting in the office of the Commissioner of Education. I know firsthand that the Public Broadcasting Act was meant to provide an alternative to commercial television and to reflect the diversity of the American people. So this, too, was on my mind when we assembled the team for now. It was just after the terrorist attacks of 9/11, and we agreed on two priorities, my colleagues and I, including my wife, Judith Davidson Partner, Judith Davidson Moyers, and my top team. We agreed on two priorities. First, we wanted to do our part to keep the conversation of democracy going. That meant talking to a wide range of people across the spectrum, left, right, and center. It meant poets, philosophers, politicians, scientists, sages, and scribblers. It meant Isabel Allende, the novelist, and Amity Shire, the columnist for the Financial Times. It meant the questing former nun and best-selling author Karen Armstrong, and it meant the right-wing evangelical columnist Cal Thomas. It meant Arundhati Roy from India, Doris Lessing from London, David Suzuki from Canada, and Bernard-Henri Levy from Paris. It also meant two successive editors of the Wall Street Journal, Robert Bartley and Paul Gigot, the editor of The Economist, Bill Emmett, the Nation's Katrina VandenHeuvel, and the Los Angeles Weekly's John Powers. It meant liberals like Frank Wu, Ossie Davis, and Gregory Nava, and conservatives like Grover Norquist, Frank Gaffney, and Richard Vigory. It meant Archbishop Desmond Tutu and Bishop Gregory, the chairman of the Catholic Bishops' Conference in this country. It meant the conservative Christian activist and lobbyist Ralph Reed and the dissident Catholic sister Joan Chittister. We threw the conversation of democracy open to all comers, and most of those who came responded the same way that Republican and Libertarian Congressman from Texas Ron Paul did, who wrote me after his appearance to say, "I've received hundreds of positive emails from your viewers. I appreciate the format of your program, which allows time for a full discussion of ideas. I'm tired of political shows featuring two guests shouting over each other and offering the same arguments. Now was truly refreshing." Hold your applause, because that's not the point of the story. We had a second priority. We intended to do strong, honest, and accurate and impartial reporting, telling stories we knew people in high places wouldn't like. I told our producers and correspondents that in our field reporting, our job was to get as close as possible to the verifiable truth. This was all the more imperative after 9/11. America could be entering a long war against elusive and stateless enemies with no definable measure of victory and no limit to its duration, cost, or foreboding fear. The rise of a homeland security state meant government could justify extraordinary measures in exchange for protecting citizens against unnamed, even unproven threats. Furthermore, increased spending during an emergency can produce a spectacle of corruption behind a smokescreen of secrecy. I reminded our team of the words of the news photographer in Tom Stoppard's play, who said people do terrible things to each other, but it's worse when everyone is kept in the dark. I reminded them of how my colleague, the correspondent and historian Richard Reeves, answered a student who asked him to define real news. Real news, Reeves answered, is the news we need to keep our freedoms. For these reasons, and in that spirit, we went about reporting on Washington as no one else in broadcasting, except occasionally 60 Minutes, was doing. We reported on the expansion of the Justice Department's power of surveillance. We reported on the escalating Pentagon budget and expensive weapons that didn't work. We reported on how campaign contributions influenced legislation and policy to skew resources to the comfortable and well-connected while our troops were fighting in Afghanistan and Iraq with inadequate training and armor. We reported on how the Bush administration was shredding the Freedom of Information Act. We went around the country to report on how closed-door, backroom deals in Washington were costing ordinary workers and taxpayers their livelihood and security. And we reported on offshore tax havens that enable wealthy and powerful Americans to avoid their fair share of national security and the social contract. And always, always, because what people know depends on who owns the press, we kept coming back to the media business itself, to how mega media corporations were pushing journalism further and further down the hierarchy of values, how giant radio cartels were silencing critics while shutting communities off from essential information, and how the mega media companies were lobbying the FCC for the right to grow ever more big, ever more powerful. The broadcast caught on. Our ratings grew every year. There was even a spell when we were the only public affairs broadcast on PBS whose audience was going up instead of down. Our journalistic peers took notice. The Los Angeles Times said Now's team of reporters has put the rest of the media to shame, pursuing stories few others bothered to touch. The Philadelphia Inquirer said our segments on the sciences, the arts, politics, and the economy were provocative public television at its best. The Austin American Statesman called Now the perfect antidote to today's high-pitched decibel level, a smart, calm, timely news program. Fraser Moore of the Associated Press said we were hard-edged when appropriate, but never hardball. Don't expect combat, he told his readers. Civility reigns on Now. And the Baton, listen to this. And the Baton Rouge Advocate said, Now invites viewers to consider the deeper implication of the daily headlines, drawing on a wide range of viewpoints which transcend the typical labels of the political left or right. Let me repeat that. Now draws on a wide range of viewpoints which transcend the typical labels of the political left or right. The Public Broadcasting Act of 1967 had been prophetic. Open public television to the American people. Offer diverse interests, ideas, and voices. Be fearless, fearless in your belief in democracy, and they will come. Hold your applause. Hold your applause. That's not the point of the story. Some of you have to go catch planes. That's all right. So do I. But I have something I want to say. And we'll never be together again like this. So I'm going to say it to those of you who can stay. The point of the story is something only a couple of my closest associates, including my wife and partner, Judith, and I knew at the time. We didn't share this with the rest of our staff. We knew that the success of Now's journalism was creating a backlash in Washington. The more compelling our journalism, the angrier became the radical right of the Republican Party. That's because the one thing they loathe more than liberals is the truth. And the quickest way to be damned by them as liberal is to tell the truth. This is the point of my story. Ideologues don't want you to go beyond the typical labels of left and right, because people may start believing you. They embrace a worldview that cannot be proven wrong, because they will admit no evidence to the contrary. They want your reporting to validate their belief system. And when it doesn't, God forbid. Never mind that their own stars were getting a fair shake on Now. Jigo, Vigory, David Keene of the American Conservative Union, Stephen Moore of the Club for Growth. Our reporting was giving the radical right fits because it wasn't the party line. It wasn't that we were getting it wrong either. Only 3 times in 3 years did we err factually, and in each case we corrected those errors as soon as we confirmed their inaccuracy. I believe our broadcast was the best researched on public broadcasting. And the problem was that we were telling stories the partisans in power didn't want told, and we were getting it right, not right wing. Let me tell you something, and we can argue about this at some other time. I've always thought the American eagle needed a left wing and a right wing. The right wing would see to it that economic interests had their legitimate concerns addressed. The left wing would see to it that ordinary people were included in the bargain. And both would keep the great bird on course. But with two right wings or two left wings, it's no longer an eagle, and it's going to crash. Now, in the interest of full disclosure, I have to tell you that my occasional, and I didn't do them that often, my occasional commentaries got to them as well. Although apparently he never watched the broadcast, I guess he couldn't take the diversity, Senator Trent Lott came out squealing like a stuck pig when, after the midterm elections in 2002, I described what was likely to happen now that all three branches of government were about to be controlled by one party dominated by the religious, corporate, and political right. Instead of congratulating the winners for their election victory, as some network broadcasters did, or celebrating their victory, as Fox, The Washington Times, The Weekly Standard, Talk Radio, and other partisan Republican journalists did, I provided a little independent analysis of what the victory meant. And I did it the old-fashioned way. I looked at the record, took the winners at their word, and drew the logical conclusions that they would use power as they had said for 25 years they would. And then, of course, I set it forth in my usual modest Texas way. Events since then have confirmed the accuracy of what I said. I had our research team, and I worked very much with them, put together the mainstream news clippings to support every sentence in that particular post-election analysis. But then, strange things begin to happen. Friends in Washington called to say that they had heard of muttered threats that the PBS reauthorization would be held up unless Moyers is dealt with. The chairman of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, Kenneth Tomlinson, was said to be quite agitated. I didn't know it at the time, but within 2 months after taking over, 3 months after taking over, he wrote a letter to PBS complaining about the unbalanced now. Apparently there was apoplexy in the right-wing area, particularly when I closed the broadcast one Friday night by putting a flag in my lapel and said, well, here's exactly what I said. Here's a copy of what I said. I wore my flag tonight, first time. Until now, I haven't thought it necessary to display a little metallic icon of patriotism for everyone to see. It was enough to vote, pay my taxes, perform my civic duties, speak my mind, and do my best to raise our kids to be good Americans. Sometimes I would offer a small prayer of gratitude that I'd been born in a country whose institutions sustained me, whose armed forces protected me, and whose ideals inspired me. I offered my heart's affection in return. It no more occurred to me to flaunt the flag on my chest than it did to pin my mother's picture on my lapel to prove her son's love. Mother knew where I stood. So does my country. I even tuck a Valentine in my tax returns on April 15th. So what's this doing here? I put it on to take it back. The flag's been hijacked and turned into a logo. The trademark of a monopoly on patriotism. On those Sunday morning talk shows, official chests appear adorned with the flag as if it's the good housekeeping seal of approval. During the State of the Union, did you notice Bush and Cheney wearing the flag? How come? No administration's patriotism is ever in doubt. Only its policies. And the flag bestows no immunity from error. When I see flags sprouting on official labels, I think of the time in China when I saw Mao's little red book of orthodoxy on every official's desk. Omnipresent and unread. But more galling than anything are all those moralistic ideologues in Washington sporting the flag in their lapels while writing books and running websites and publishing magazines attacking dissenters as un-American. They are people whose ardor for war grows disproportionately to their distance from the fighting. They're in the same league as those swarms of corporate lobbyists wearing flags and prowling Capitol Hill for tax breaks, even as they call for spending more on war. So I put this on as a modest riposte to men with flags in their lapels who shoot missiles from the safety of Washington think tanks, or argue that sacrifice is good as long as they don't have to make it, or approve of bribing governments to join the coalition of the willing. I put it on to remind myself that not every patriot thinks we should do to the people of Baghdad what bin Laden did to us. The flag belongs to the country, not to the government. And it reminds me that it's not un-American to think that war, except in self-defense, is a failure of moral imagination, political nerve, and diplomacy. Come to think of it, standing up to your government can mean standing up for your country. That did it. You should have heard Ann Coulter at the next conservative convention. I think that's where she got the title for her book about Democrats and treason. That did it. And our continuing reporting on overpricing at Halliburton, chicanery on K Street, and the heavy, if divinely guided, hand of Tom DeLay. When Senator Lott protested that the Corporation for Public Broadcasting has not seemed willing to deal with Bill Moyers, a new member of the board, a Republican fundraiser named Cheryl Halperin, who had been appointed by President Bush, agreed that CPB needed more power to do just that sort of thing. She left no doubt about the kind of penalties she would like to see imposed on the malefactors. Now, hear me again. As rumors circulated about all this, I asked to meet with the entire CBS board. I wanted to hear for myself what they were saying. I thought it would be helpful for someone like me who'd been present at the creation and part of the system for almost 40 years to talk about how CPB had been intended to be a heat shield to protect public broadcasters from exactly this kind of intimidation. After all, I'd been there at the time of Richard Nixon's attempted coup. In those days, public television had been really feisty and independent, and often targeted for attacks. A Woody Allen special that poked fun at Henry Kissinger and the Nixon administration had actually been canceled. John Stewart wouldn't have stood a chance if he'd started his career on PBS. The White House had been so outraged over a documentary called The Banks and the Poor about discrimination by rich financial institutions against the poor that PBS was driven to adopt new guidelines. That didn't satisfy Nixon, and when public television hired two NBC reporters, the radicals Robert McNeil and Sander Van Oker, to co-anchor some new broadcast, it was for Nixon the last straw. According to White House memos of the time, he was determined, quote, to get the left-wing commentators who are cutting us up off public television at once. Indeed, yesterday, if possible. Sound familiar? Nixon vetoed the authorization for CPB with a message written in part by his sidekick and soulmate, Pat Buchanan, who castigated Van Oker, McNeil, Washington Week in Review, Black Journal, and Bill Moyers as, quote, unbalanced against the administration. It is familiar. I always knew Nixon would be back again and again. I just didn't know that this time he would ask to be chairman of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Buchanan and Nixon succeeded in cutting CPB funding for all public affairs programming except for Black Journal. They knocked out multi-year funding for the National Public Affairs Center for Television, otherwise known as NPAC. And they voted to take away from the PBS staff the ultimate responsibility for the production of programming. But in those days, and this is what I wanted to share with Kenneth Tomlinson, who I had never met, and his colleagues on the CPB board. In those days, there were still Republicans in America who did not march in ideological lockstep and who stood on principle against politicizing public television. The chairman of the public station in Dallas was an industrialist named Ralph Rogers, a Republican but no party hack, who saw the White House intimidation as an assault on freedom of the press and led a nationwide effort to stop it. The chairman at the time of the CPB was a former Republican congressman, Thomas Curtis, from here in St. Louis, from here in Missouri, who was also a principled man. He resigned, claiming White House interference. Within a few months, the crisis was over, CPB maintained its independence, PBS grew in strength, and Richard Nixon would face impeachment and resign for violating the public trust and not just public broadcasting. Paradoxically, the very talk about justice, in fact, I once asked a friend of mine, a wise old man in Washington, what he'd learned from life. Could he reduce it to one sentence? And he said, yes, there ain't no justice in the world. Now get on with it. But here was cosmic justice. The very Public Affairs Center for Television that Nixon had tried to kill, NPAC, put PBS on the map by rebroadcasting in prime time each day's Watergate hearings, drawing huge ratings night after night, and establishing PBS as an ally of democracy. We should still be doing that sort of thing. C-SPAN, bless its heart, shouldn't be the only channel, shouldn't be the only channel that lets us see how democracy works. That was 33 years ago, and I thought the current CPB board would like to hear and talk about the importance of standing up to political interference. I was wrong. They wouldn't meet with me. I tried three times and failed three times. And it was all downhill after that. I was naive, I guess. I simply never imagined that any CPB chairman, Democrat or Republican, would cross the line from resisting White House pressure to carrying it out for the White House. But that's what Kenneth Tomlinson has been doing. On Fox News this week, he denied he's carrying out a White House mandate or that he's ever had any conversation with any Bush administration official about PBS. But the New York Times reports that he enlisted Karl Rove to help kill a proposal that would have put on the CPB board people with experience in local radio and television. It was also reported that on the recommendation of administration officials, he hired a White House flack, I know the genre, named Mary Catherine Andrews as a senior staff member at CPB. While she was still reporting to Karl Rove at the White House, she set up CPB's new ombudsman office and had a hand in hiring the two people who will fill it. One of them who once worked for Tomlinson, the other a very respected journalist. But this is an anomaly. A political organization can't have an ombudsman. CPB is not a journalistic or news-gathering organization. PBS can have one. WGBH can have one. WNET can have one. But for a political organization to have two ombudsmen, or one ombudsman, or a dozen. I would like to give Mr. Tomlinson the benefit of the doubt, but I can't. According to a book written about the Reader's Digest when he was its editor-in-chief, he surrounded himself with other right-wingers, a pattern he's now following for the staff at the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I've already mentioned Ms. Andrews. Well, for acting president, he hired Ken Ferrer from the FCC, who was Michael Powell's enforcer when Powell was deciding how to go about allowing the big media companies to get even bigger. One of Ferrer's jobs, as Jeff Chester will say in his book coming out in the next several months, was to engage in tactics designed to dismiss any serious objection to more media monopolies. And according to Eric Altman, Ferrer was even more contemptuous than Michael Powell of public participation in the process of determining media ownership. It was Ferrer who decided to issue a protective order designed to keep secret the market research on which the Republican majority on the commission based their vote to permit greater media consolidation. Now, let me say, it is not likely that with a guy like that as the chief operating officer of the CPB, you're going to find any public television producer saying, hey, let's do something on how big media is affecting democracy. Because what this leads to is preventive capitulation. And as everyone knows, Mr. Tomlinson has put up a considerable sum of money, allegedly over $5 million, your money, for the new weekly broadcast featuring Paul Gigot and the editorial board of the Wall Street Journal. Now, Gigot is a smart journalist, a sharp editor, and a fine fellow. I had him on Now several times, and I even proposed to PBS that he become a regular contributor on our show, The Conversation of Democracy, remember? All stripes. But I confess to some puzzlement that the Wall Street Journal, which in the past editorialized to cut PBS off the public tap, is now being subsidized by American taxpayers when its parent company, Dow Jones, had revenues in the first quarter of this year of $400 million. I thought public television was supposed to be an alternative to commercial media, not a funder of it. But in this weird deal, you get a glimpse of the kind of programming Mr. Tomlinson apparently seems to prefer. Alone of the big major newspapers, the Wall Street Journal has no op-ed page where different opinions can compete with its right-wing editorials. The journal's PBS broadcast is just as homogenous, right-wingers talking to each other. I think, Bob McChesney, you ought to demand equal time for Katrina Vandenhoevel and the editors of The Nation, or for Amy Goodman's Democracy. Now, there's an idea for you. You want public broadcasting to be balanced against all these elite establishment voices that get heard? Get Amy on public television. We didn't know this a year ago. We just learned it from the New York Times 2 weeks ago, that last year Mr. Tomlinson had spent $10,000 to hire a contractor who would watch my show and report on political bias. That's right. He spent $10,000 of your money to hire a guy to watch now to find out who my guests were and what my stories were. $10,000. Gee, Ken, for $2.50 a week, you could pick up a copy of TV Guide on the newsstand. A subscription is even cheaper, and I would have sent you a coupon that can save you up to 62%. Or, for that matter, Ken, all you had to do was watch the show. You could have made it easier with a double Jim Beam, your favorite. Or you could... Mine, too. We have some things in common. Or you could go online where the listings are posted. Hell, Ken, you could have called me collect and I would have told you who we were having on the show. $10,000. That would have bought 5 tables at Thursday night's conservative salute to their patron saint, Tom DeLay. Better yet, that 10 grand would pay for the books in an elementary school classroom or an upgrade of its computer lab. But having sent that cash, what did he find? Only Mr. Tomlinson knows. He'd apparently decided not to share the results with his staff or with the board or even to leak it to Robert Novak. I mean, when a right-winger won't leak to Robert Novak, you know he doesn't want it to go up the food chain of the right-wing echo chamber. The public paid for that study. But Ken Tomlinson acts as if he owns it. Let's see it. You can watch my bias. You can watch my mistakes. You can watch everything I do right there on the air. We have the funders listed. Everything is there. It's all listed. But he won't do it. In a May 10th op-ed piece in Reverend Moon's conservative Washington Times, Ken Tomlinson maintained he had not released the findings because public broadcasting is such a delicate institution. He did not want to, quote, damage public broadcasting's image with controversy. Where I come from in Texas, we shovel that kind of stuff every day. As we learned this week, that's not the only news Mr. Tomlinson tried to keep to himself. As Dr. Wilson indicated, and as reported by Jeff Chester's Center for Digital Democracy, which the Human Center for Media and Democracy also support, there were 2 public opinion surveys commissioned by CPB, but not released to the media, not even to PBS and NPR. According to a source who talked to Salam.com, the first results were too good, and Tomlinson didn't believe them. After the Iraq War, the board commissioned another round of polling, and they thought they'd get worse results, but they didn't. This is the man, by the way, who was running the Voice of America back in 1984, when a fanatic named Charlie Wick was politicizing the United States Information Agency, of which Voice of America was a part. It turned out there was a blacklist of people who had been removed from the list of prominent Americans sent abroad to lecture on behalf of America and the USIA. What's more, it was discovered that evidence as to how those people were chosen to be on the blacklist, more than 700 documents, had been shredded. Among those on the blacklist of journalists, writers, scholars, and politicians were dangerous left-wing subversives like Walter Cronkite, James Baldwin, Gary Hart, Ralph Nader, Ben Bradley, Coretta Scott King, and David Brinkley. The person who took the fall for the blacklist was another right-winger. He resigned. Shortly thereafter, so did Kenneth Tomlinson, who was one of 6 people in the agency with the authority to see the list of potential speakers and allowed to strike people's names. Let me be clear. I don't know And there's no record of what position Kenneth Thomason took, whether he supported the blacklist or opposed it, or what he thinks of it now. I actually hoped Bill O'Reilly would have asked him about it when he appeared on the O'Reilly Factor this week. He didn't. Instead, Thomason went on attacking me, with O'Reilly egging him on, and went on denying he was carrying out a partisan mandate. The only time you could be sure he was telling the truth was at the end of the broadcast when he said to O'Reilly, "We love your show." We love your show? He's entitled to his opinion. He's entitled to his politics. He's entitled to contribute exclusively, as he does, to conservative candidates for public office. That's all fine. Our political system encourages it and tolerates it. But he is not entitled to stand in judgment on other people's bias. On Friday, I wrote Kenneth Thomason. I asked him to sit down with me for an hour on PBS and talk about all this. I said, "You can choose the moderator, although I don't see that we need one, two civilized human beings sitting and talking about these important issues affecting the future of a medium we both profess to love." I said, "You can choose the guidelines. But there's one thing in particular," and I'm about to close. "There's one thing in particular I would like to ask him about." In that op-ed essay this week in the Washington Times, Ken Thomason talks of a phone call from an old friend complaining about Bill Moyer's bias. The friend explained that the foundation he heads made a six-figure contribution to his local public television station for digital conversion. But he declared, and I'm quoting Thomason, there would be no more contributions until something was done about the network's bias. Apparently, that's Kenneth Thomason's method of governance. Money talks and buys the influence it wants. But I'd like to ask him to listen to a different voice. This letter came to me last year, 5 pages of handwriting. It said, in essence, and I'm going to do some direct quoting, "After the worst sneak attack in our history, there's not been a moment to reflect, a moment to let the horror resonate, to feel the pain and regroup as humans. No, since I lost my husband on 9/11, not only our family's world, but the whole world seems to have gotten even worse than that tragic day. On 9/11, my husband was not on duty. He was home with me, having coffee. Our own family story on that day is long and complicated. My daughter and grandson, living only 5 blocks from the tower, had to be evacuated with marks, terror all around. My other daughter, near the Brooklyn Bridge, my son in high school. But my Charlie took off like a lightning bolt to be with his men from the Special Operations Command. Bring my gear to the plaza, he told his aide immediately after the first plane struck the North Tower. In comparison to using semantical technicalities, passing the responsibility, or not having all the facts, he took action based on the responsibility he felt for his job and his men and for those towers he loved. In the Fire Department of New York chain of command, rules extend to every captain of every firehouse in the city. If anything happens in the firehouse at any time, even if the captain isn't on duty and is on vacation, that captain is responsible for everything that goes on there 24/7. Why then, she asked, are the people in Washington responsible for nothing? Why do they pass the blame for what happened that day, for the failure of the system, for the torture at Abu Ghraib, for sending young soldiers into an immoral war, under-equipped, under-trained, and under-protected? Why is there no leadership? We need more programs like Now to wake us up, she said. More programs like Now and your series with Joseph Campbell, which my husband and I so enjoyed watching together. Such programs must continue amidst the sea of false images and name-calling that divide America now. Such programs give us hope that search will continue to get this imperfect human condition onto a higher plane. So thank you, and all of those who worked with you at Channel 13, my flagship station, and PBS. Without public broadcasting, all we would call news would be very carefully controlled propaganda. Framed above my desk at my office is the check she made out to Channel 13 Now for $500. When I go discouraged or need to remind myself that public media truly matter, I look at that check and think of the woman who wrote it and the husband who did his duty and their belief in us. And I will take over the big check that Ken Thomason could have gotten from a demanding right winger. I would take the widow's mite any day. That great raucous mob that is democracy is rarely heard, and that's not just the fault of the current residents of the White House and the Capitol. There's too great a chasm between those of us in this business and those who depend on TV and radio as their window to the world. We treat them too much like audiences and not enough like citizens. They're invited to look through the window, but too infrequently to come through the door and to participate to make public broadcasting truly public. I was deeply touched by the two speakers who preceded me and would yield gladly any of my time to hear more of what they had to say. To that end, five public interest groups, including Common Cause and the Consumers Union, will be holding informational sessions around the country to take public broadcasting back, to take it back, to take it back from threats, from interference, from those of who would tell us we can only think what they command us to think. It's a worthy goal. Thank you, Ken. One last point. We're big kids. We can handle controversy and diversity. Whether it's a political or religious points of view or two loving lesbian moms and their kids visited by a cartoon rabbit. We're not too fragile or insecure to see America and the world entire for all their magnificent and sometimes violent confusion. There used to be a thing or commodity we put a store by, John Steinbeck wrote. It was called the people. Thank you. Thank you.